We are currently in the middle of the biggest refugee crisis in the world. And while the narrative in this country and throughout much of Europe focuses on whether or not refugees are somehow a threat, the stories that go overlooked are the economies that have been created to manage and often to exploit these refugees. The investigative journalists Malia Pulitzer and Emily Cossey went around the world to document their new refugee economy. Their latest story in the Huffington Post Highline, The 21st Century Gold Rush, How the Refugee Crisis is Changing the World Economy. And I'm very pleased they join us now. Hi, guys.
Hi,
how are you?
Thank you so much for having us on.
Absolutely. Malia, you profiled four places, Niger, Italy, Turkey, and Germany. Why those locations?
Well, it was actually a pretty tough choice to choose between all the different possibilities. Turkey was pretty obvious just because they have 2.7 million of the Syrian refugees, so they have over half of them. And we definitely wanted one of the bigger destination countries, which, you know, Germany is one of the bigger ones in Europe. And then for me, it was just really important also to acknowledge the African refugee route, which I think oftentimes gets overlooked when we're talking about this global refugee crisis. So Italy obviously became very important because that's where a lot of people end up when they're crossing. And then, you know, we were thinking of going to Libya, but then we thought, yeah, maybe not. So we decided on Agadez because that is such an interesting and prominent smuggling hub.
Right. So describe Agadez. This is town where you start this whole journey out. And just for those who haven't seen, this is a lavishly, very exhaustively reported story, visually very dynamic and interactive. Just tell me a little about this city in Niger.
Right. So when we had arrived in Agadez, we had expected, you know, to see smugglers and migrants who were populating the city so that they could move through the desert and the Sahara and get up to Libya and eventually hopefully up to Europe. And the city itself, you know, you're talking about these kind of clay brick houses and an economy that used to be based on traveling routes through the Sahara where traders would come to pass along goods and has been completely transformed now into this smuggling economy. So when we arrived, we expected to find smugglers and migrants, but what we didn't expect to find were the drug and weapons and sex trafficking routes that have emerged as well.
Yeah, and I think that brings me to one of what I found the most frustrating aspects of the story, or rather what's happening there, is how the same people who are transporting refugees or trafficking sex slaves out of some of these countries, they're also bringing arms and supplies back to the groups that are destabilizing those regions. So in a sense, they're actually deliberately fueling the problem, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely what we saw. And I think that one of the things that became quite clear is also there's a lot of motivation to kind of keep this movement going, right? So some of the people we spoke to, if they didn't have enough migrants, they would actually go and physically recruit them from some of the villages to try to convince people to go, because that became their source of livelihood.
So how would they do that?
Like just literally go in a truck. I mean, they also have some contacts. Basically each of these ghettos, the ghetto is where people are kept, migrants are kept in Agadez before they get on these trucks to go to Libya. And each of the ghetto owners kind of has what they call a passer who's a part of it. And so some of those passers have networks of local contacts in some of the descending regions. So, for example, this guy, Khalid, that we profiled, is originally from Gambia but had a lot of contacts in Burkina Faso and Gambia. And he said that just about every weekend he would be traveling to some villages in Burkina Faso to bring people for recruitment. So oftentimes it's just physically going there, kind of making a pitch, telling people what a great opportunity they're going to have in Europe and bringing them there.
And are these people, drawn to this pitch because conditions are so bad or because they simply have this idea that Europe is this, you know, this kind of crystal city?
Well, you know, it's a mix between economic deprivation in so many of these countries and also, you know, people fleeing groups that have populated the region, terrorist groups and other sorts of causes like climate change that have depleted economic opportunities for them. And especially the women who are trafficked up there are promised jobs and prosperity and possibility to kind of start a new life in these countries, and then are taken to these places that they didn't expect to go and forced to work in the sex trade until their debts are paid off.
This is Arun Venugopal. I'm sitting in for Leonard today, and I'm talking to investigative journalists Malia Pulitzer and Emily Kasi about their Huffington Post Highline story, The 21st Century Gold Rush, How the Refugee Crisis is Changing the World Economy. Malia, you write that there are all these McMansions popping up in Agadez, but also that merely taking pictures of them can be dangerous. But in fact, you do have photos in this story. Were either of you ever concerned about your safety when reporting the story or documenting it?
I'm going to pass this one to Emily because she's the brilliant photographer.
So I remember taking those photos, and we really did need to do quite a bit of sneaking around. Malia and I conducted a lot of our interviews behind bushes, and we would have to move locations several times if the smugglers weren't feeling, comfortable in those areas, just in case there were police crawling around, even though a lot of the time the police are kind of in on it. And then in terms of the houses, these are the houses of the kind of mafia running the show. So we had to be very careful about poking the bear and making sure that we didn't get too involved to the point where we were jeopardizing our own safety. And then the other point of in which we were a little bit concerned was when we were dealing with the prostitutes. We were working with their pimps as well as the prostitutes themselves, and some of them were asking for help. And so we had to kind of make a decision on the spot and know where to draw the line and where we could actually play a role without jeopardizing their and our safety.
I mean, one of these pictures you have in Agadez is of this passer, as you call him, a shepherd of sorts, who kind of moves people along through the whole migration or refugee route. You have a picture of him on his motorcycle. He seems to have no problem posing for you. I'm just wondering if people like him feel there were no potential consequences for them being exposed. Did you just gain their trust over a lot of time?
Yeah, so, you know, I think it was a bit of a mix. And I think when we first approached them, it took us a while before we could really get them to open up. But as Malia can talk a little bit about, some of them took a lot of pride in the work they were doing, such as Khalid, the guy on the motorcycle.
Yeah, I think part of it, too, was, I mean, if you look at some other reporting that's come out of Agadez, most people don't get the pictures that Emily was able to get of people who are uncovered. And I honestly think that us being two kind of youngish women reporting in there was somewhat disarming. I think people weren't as on guard with us as they might have been with other reporters because of it. So I think that was an advantage in some ways.
That's interesting. But as far as pimps go, why would they... What did you think was their motivation for opening up to you?
Yeah, that was really interesting. I mean, to me, it was really interesting in general how much access we got. Neither of us were really expecting it. And I do think part of the reason is because it is such an open secret. I mean, this is something where the government is actually taxing cars that are leaving Agadez. Like, there's actually a road tax. And so there's these trucks that are jam-packed with all of these migrants that then have to pay a representative of the government, like a certain amount of money before they leave the city. So I do think that there's kind of this sense that this is all business as usual. But in terms of the pimp, I think that was the one where I actually felt was the one that felt the riskiest to me, because he was clearly not happy that we were there when we were talking to the prostitute and was very nervous. And so we had to cut that particular interview pretty short because it felt pretty dicey.
So who are the new members of the elite in Agadez, these people who are building these McMansions?
So we're seeing, a kind of structure playing out, and that starts with these kind of mafia bosses that are at the top of the structure, and then you have the pastors, and you have the managers, and you have the car owners and the car drivers. So there is an entire chain, really, that passes all the way to Libya, and then Libya, of course, has its own chain. So this is an intricate system, very informal, but over time is being continuously solidified.
And you also see some of these traditional groups, like, for example, one of the main reasons why Agadez has so naturally become this smuggling hub is not just because of its geographical position, but also because of the history of it. So Agadez in the 15th century was this big, like, basically a trading post. And then there are these two indigenous groups of the region, the Tuaregs and the Tubu, who were the traders who went through the desert. So they know these routes really, really well. And so they have really emerged as major players in terms of the truck drivers, truck can navigate the Sahara if someone else could. This happened in part because of the tourism industry being decimated at the same time that Libya's the Libya collapsed and their borders opened, and the economy of Agadez collapsed. So all of that came together when the migrants were coming, and it just naturally a lot of people kind of adapted the traditional jobs to smuggling, because that was where the money was.
Emily, aside from these huge houses that you saw and photographed, what are the other kinds of signs of wealth in the city? Is there a sort of recreation or other things that's happening now?
Yeah, I remember sitting in some of these small little apartments that lower level players in the smuggling business were living in. And, you know, they would be in a traditional kind of clay and mud housing, but inside they'd have a big flat screen TV. And a brand new car parked outside, and more on that front. So we actually were spending time in a particular compound, the front of that compound was a grocery store, very typical grocery store. But again, they had full blown air conditioning and a flat screen TV, and a couple cars. So you can kind of see those areas of wealth starting to increase.
My guests are the investigative journalists Malia Pulitzer and Emily Kasi. Their latest article for the Huffington Post Highline is The 21st Century Gold Rush, How the Refugee Crisis is Changing the World Economy. I'm Arun Vanigopal in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. This is Arun Vanigopal. I'm sitting in for Leonard Lopate today, and I'm talking to the investigative journalists Malia Pulitzer and Emily Kasi about their new story in the Huffington Post Highline about the new refugee economy and how people and entire systems are developing around exploiting the refugee crisis. Emily, one of the startling things that you discovered after the story has moved on from Niger, you've crossed the Sahara, not you personally, but these refugees who've either crossed it or perhaps died in it. You land in Sicily and you discovered that there is an alternate mafia that is developing there, a Nigerian one. How did this happen?
Right. So one of the really interesting things about Italy is when you get to this area in Palermo, we're looking at called Ballaro. It's one of the most interesting parts of the city because it really displays what's happened there. By day, it's this vibrant market, and then by night, it transforms into drug dens and prostitution run by this Nigerian almost sub-mafia called the Black Axe. And if you go to another area in Ballaro, you'll see the members of the Cosa Nostra, who are the Sicilian mafia, who are drinking and hanging out. And the development of the Black Axe under Cosa Nostra has really surged in the last few years. And I'll let Malia talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, so it's actually pretty interesting how this developed. Part of it was because recently Cosa Nostra has gotten a lot weaker. Like, the authorities have been cracking down and putting people in jail. And around the same time, you had this migrant surge and a lot more of these Nigerians coming. So what's actually developed is Cosa Nostra has kind of formed almost an alliance with the Black Axe, which recently, by the way, like the past 3 weeks, has now been declared an official second mafia in Sicily, which is the first time they've ever had another mafia, which is a pretty big deal. So they almost are kind of the I want to say the subordinates to Cosa Nostra. Like they're the ones who buy the drugs from them, like the dealers, the big dealers of Cosa Nostra. The Black Axe deals them on the street. So then if the prosecutors, you know, if someone arrests them, the drug dealers in the jails are pretty much all Black Axe members or African migrants in general, because they also end up getting sucked into this ring.
And the Black Axe is not just a cute name. This is, they, as you document, they actually literally carry around axes. Am I right?
Yeah, they do, and machetes. And that's partially because the Sicilian mafia does not allow guns in their territory. So the way that the Black Axe kind of keeps discipline in their community and keeps power is through violence, but primarily axes and machetes.
So how brazen is this? I mean, is this something that one might see in public, or is it fairly behind closed doors, or what?
So, like I was saying earlier, it's really, you'll see it most in this area called Ballaro, and you won't really see it during the day. In the day, you'll see this kind of beautiful tourist hub, beaches and markets, and just kind of a great vacation spot. And then at night, you don't really want to be in this area. There are drug dealers on the street that you can see selling heroin, selling hash, and people getting into cars to buy these drugs, or women getting into cars for prostitution. And if you enter any of these little pubs, they call them, you'll be entering a drug den, and you'll see people doing heroin and trading money and doing all of these sorts of things. So it's not exactly a place that tourists are likely to be at night, and probably not one that they should be going to.
So if the mafia is involved, Malia, who determines what happens to refugees, whether they get housing or food or asylum?
Well, there is a refugee system, right, an asylum system in Italy. But usually what happens when migrants reach is they get channeled into one of these big refugee camps. We visited one of them called Moria, which is, I think, one of the largest in Europe, actually. And they're there while their asylum applications are being processed. What's interesting is actually the mafia, the Sicilian mafia Cosa Nostra, also has their thumb in that pie, too. Because right now, prosecutors in Sicily are investigating all of these skimming operations where they expect that they've kind of intimidated other companies from servicing these refugee shelters, and that they put their own companies there and are basically providing inferior services and pocketing the difference, and also pocketing the migrants' spending money. They're supposed to get like €2.50 per day, and instead they get a pack of cigarettes every 2 days, which apparently the son-in-law of a local mafia member owns a cigarette factory, so they sell it to the refugee camp, and if people want their spending money, they have to sell the cigarettes. So they're really everywhere, and it's very much a part, like the refugees have really become profitable for Cosa Nostra in a number of different ways.
This is Arun Vanigopal. I'm sitting in for Leonard today, and I'm speaking to Malia Pulitzer and Emily Cossi, investigative journalists whose most recent article is The 21st Century Gold Rush, How the Refugee Crisis is Changing the World Economy. Emily, is the Italian government able to combat these mob operations in any significant way?
Well, I think this is something that they're trying to do, and we did speak with a number of undercover cops and, prosecutors who are fielding these cases every day and are trying to prosecute and break up these operations. You know, they're busting ships and they're breaking into different sorts of brothels and arresting people. But on a grand scale, it's a little bit more difficult.
I just wanted to add something to that, which is one of the things that I find the most interesting about this entire dynamic is one of the primary reasons that you now see Cosa Nostra working with the Black Axe is because the prosecutors have done such a good job cracking down on Cosa Nostra. Because I think, several prosecutors made the point And I think that it makes sense that if Cosa Nostra hadn't been weakened so much in the past few years, they never would have had the need to kind of rely on the Black Axe as this reserve labor force. And their reliance on that has also really bolstered the power of the Black Axe and given them this international reputation. So now they're kind of big guys when it comes to African mafia networks.
Malia, when you visited Turkey, you found a totally different set of problems with the migrants there. There seems to be a very big market for child labor. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, so the child labor one is something both Emily and I were really sad to see, obviously. And it's happening for a number of reasons. Of course, as I mentioned before, Turkey has most of the Syrian refugees in the world now. They have 2.7 million. And technically, these kids are allowed to be enrolled in school. They're permitted to attend Turkish schools, but practically speaking, they're not able to do so because they don't speak Turkish. And at the same time, their families, even though legally should be able to obtain work permits, and there was a law that was passed recently to allow them to do that, practically speaking, it's very difficult for them to do so because the companies need to do so on their behalf. So what ends up happening is Syrians end up in the informal labor market making very little money and just have to rely on their children to survive. So no one wants their kids to be working in these factories, but they just don't have any choice.
Are there strong child labor laws in Turkey?
I don't think there's strong child labor laws. There is a law. I mean, it is illegal. It's not permitted, but clearly they're not cracking down on it. I mean, when we were in Gaziantep, we were actually sitting down across interviewing this guy from the Chamber of Commerce, and he said, yeah, we know that this is happening. And basically, no one's cracking down on it because we know that people have to make money somehow, and this is the way that Syrians are able to do it.
How much money are they these kids making? Any sense?
Making 100 a month. Sorry, go ahead, Emily.
Yeah, Malia said they're making 100 a month or less, often less than half of what a regular Turkish worker would make. And these kids are they're working up to 16-hour days. And just adding on to when we were sitting across from that guy at the Chamber of Commerce, he kind of made this comment where he said, "Child labor's bad, but that's capitalism." And I think that really shook both of us because we realize that it means that there's not really a way out for these kids. And when we went into these factories, a lot of people weren't even shy about having child workers, and some really were. But we were walking into massive factories where there were kids as young as six, and they were wearing flip-flops, and there were heavy fumes and terrible conditions. And it was, it was quite heartbreaking to see these kids with no access to education, working these long-hour shifts.
It's hard to imagine, Emily, that this is happening without, significant, I guess, aspects of the government and law enforcement being paid off and just looking the other way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's difficult to say exactly how far their hand is in this situation. But again, as Malia was saying, this is also one of the only options in this kind of informal economy that has emerged with this unprecedented number of Syrian refugees in Turkey who have just started up all of these kind of underground factories. You can walk down a street in Istanbul and it can seem completely silent, like possibly just a residential area. And then if you go into the basement of any of these places or into the attics, you're going to find sweatshops. So, it is a combination of what they can actually manage to monitor and what they actually care to monitor.
And also, I mean, when we talk to some of these factory owners, the way that they phrase it, like they seem to kind of justify it by thinking they're doing these families a favor. Like sometimes the families will actually approach them and say, we really need our child to be working, like he wants a job, and usually there's 10, 12-year-old kids, 14-year-old kids who will ask the manager for a job. So some of the managers were actually almost bragging that, yeah, he's not really useful to me, but I'm helping them out, like I'm doing my part. So that I think some of them saw themselves as kind of almost benefactors for these kids by giving them a job.
And Emily, Malia, who these factories are selling to? Are they selling goods in the U.S.? Is it clear?
Yeah, well, this is not one of the things that we found, but I've read pieces written by other people later on that found that, yeah, some of the companies, like H&M, I think, was one of them. There are some pretty high-profile companies that ended up hiring or subcontracting these other factories that had suppliers that were these smaller textile workshops that were hiring Syrian kids.
And I think one of the other interesting things is that a lot of these companies are trading or sending products into Syria, and those products go to all sorts of groups, whether it's to rebel groups or ISIS even. And so it's almost like these factories are almost fueling or helping continuing the war in Syria that these kids and families are escaping from. So there is some irony to that. And, you know, some of these factory owners aren't as proud or see themselves as doing a favor. There was one factory that Malia and I visited where we were told by the owner of the factory that they absolutely did not have child workers. They would never do that. Child labor is really bad. And then, you know, he wanted to show off his factory, so he brought us in. And we walk in, and there are, you know, tens of children just running around. And he started panicking. And we actually had to try to distract him, and I had to get as many shots as I could. And we had to hide the actual SD card that had that information on it because he was demanding us to delete the photos. So, you know, there is a mix.
Now, in contrast with Turkey, you write that Germany is showing the rest of the world how to monetize refugees on an industrial scale. Malia, how exactly is Germany doing that?
Well, so in Germany, the crisis basically became privatized almost accidentally, in a way. Like, when we were in Berlin, and we met with some of the government agencies that were trying to deal with this crisis, they outlined this really chaotic scene where you had thousands of people showing up every day, and they needed to put them places. Like, there needed to be out of the cold. It was sub-zero weather, so people were, you know, families, pregnant women, in the snow, and they just didn't have enough places to put them. So at first they were calling all of the big NGOs, and then they started calling basically anybody who could put together a quick private company to run an emergency refugee shelter in a gymnasium or whatnot. So that was the first stage. And then eventually some of the bigger players started figuring out how to turn this into a more long-term profitable endeavor.
Well, I'm just curious, in a couple minutes that we have left, in terms of, you know, your take on this with Germany, do you think, was Angela Merkel wrong to open the door to so many refugees? Or do you think she did the right thing?
Well, you know, so I think that right now, and this is one of the notes, this is what we tried to end it on, I think that right now Germany is really faced with a choice. One of the main reasons that Merkel opened the door to refugees was not purely altruistic. It's because Germany is facing some huge demographic issues. They really need people to be coming in and fulfilling and filling the labor force and all of these job gaps that they have. The problem is, so these refugees do have the potential to do that, but only if they're integrating properly. Now, what does that mean? It means that they need to be able to get into the job market as soon as possible. They need to be able to learn German. But in order for them to do that, they need to have the continuous support of the German people to continue to fund these language programs, which is kind of the critical entry point, because if they can't speak German well enough, they can't get into those jobs. So I think right now, Germany's at a really critical point.
I've been speaking with the investigative journalists Malia Pulitzer and Emily Cossey. Their latest article for the Huffington Post Highline is The 21st Century Gold Rush, How the Refugee Crisis is Changing the World Economy. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back.